It's a great pleasure to be involved in this session, which, of course, celebrates the 75th anniversary of the New Deal, and also acknowledges the great work of people involved in the Federal Writers Project, work that they did to create a unique, rich, diverse portrait of America, which is like nothing else that has ever been done in the nation's history. And they did it, among other ways, through their documentation of oral histories and folklore. Now, as Don mentioned, I work at the Library of Congress at the American Folklife Center there. And our archive, which was founded in 1928, is the proud home of many of these documentary materials, including field recordings and researchers' field notes and logs, photographs, and other associated materials. Materials that were created by such pioneering field workers as Alan Lomax and Herbert Halpert and Sidney Robertson Cowell and Alton Morris, Charles Seeger, Zora Neale Hurston, and today's guest of honor, Stetson Kennedy. Now, one reason that we have these materials is that it was our policy at that time to lend out state-of-the-art recording equipment to people in the WPA Writers Project who could put this equipment, this federal property, to good and immediate use. And the deal was, here, we'll send you the equipment, we'll send you even blank discs. These were instantaneous disc-cutting machines, that's state-of-the-art, 1930s. And in return, we ask that you send us duplicates or send us the originals. We'll create duplicates, send back the originals to you. And that worked out very nicely. And we'll find out more about that from Stetson, how that worked from his perspective and what it was like to operate that material, that equipment too, perhaps. Now today, getting down to business, it's my honor to share this platform with Stetson Kennedy, writer, folklorist, fearless champion of civil rights and social justice. And Stetson, as you know, has kindly agreed to let me interview him. And I asked him a couple of days ago if I could bring a few friends, and he said, yeah, that was all right. So in this cozy atmosphere, we're going to proceed to talk about what it was like to work on a WPA Arts project, that is the folklore aspect of the Federal Writers Project in Florida. And I've got a lot of questions about that, and I'm going to ask them and see where this goes. Every interview is an adventure, as you know, and there'll be some things that I have never heard about or even thought about coming up, probably. And we'll go for 20 or 30 minutes or so, and then we'll turn it over to you for follow-up questions. So, here we go. Well, hi, Stetson. How are you doing today?
Well, glad to be here.
Thanks for having us over.
Used to say down south, just so proud to be here. Anyway, I appreciate the invitation, and it's very gratifying to me, and I'm very happy to have lived so long as to be here with you.
Well, as you know, when we talked the other day, I said I wanted to find out more about what it was like to work for the Federal Writers Project. And before I get into that, though, I wanted to ask how you first got involved in collecting folklore. Can you tell me about that?
Later.
Later, okay.
Okay.
David, I can't help but feel that we're in no position to spend too much time on oral history as usual. We're in a situation where nothing is as usual. Our presidential candidates, when the meltdown came, all of their campaign rhetoric became somewhat moot because we were facing something that's changed everything. And I think it probably behooves us to think and talk about that And we can talk a little bit about the elders, if you like.
Well, let's start with that. I think that's a fine idea.
And it's going on 80 years since the meltdown of 1929. And it occurs to me, sitting here, that if the Oral History Association on Trust will still be here, and if in another 80 years we'll be seeing a film about voices from the 2010s, because that's what we're looking at. And nobody knows how far it's going to go or how bad it's going to get. I'm worried about the fact that back then, you know, we weren't as rich as we are now. There were millions of people who were borderline and deep in poverty and homeless and hungry and sick and jobless. But we've gone through many decades. I remember the head of the American Chamber of Commerce mid-century was talking about, he raises the slogan, build the middle class. And America did proceed to build the middle class. And a lot of the barefoot people were found themselves with a car in the garage and perhaps a motorboat out on the lawn and a brick cottage instead of a wooden one. And we all felt that we were sitting on top of the world and, you know, looking at nothing but a bright future. But then things began to happen, and I remember hearing Martin Luther King say, been down so long, down don't bother me. And this was something of a truth back then. But I'm worried about how we well-off Americans by the millions, if we get plunged into the bottom rung of the economic ladder. Traditionally, that rung has been reserved for people with dark complexions. But it looks like an awful lot of white collar is going to be on the bottom rung in very short notice. And those people back then were survivors. And my concern now is, to what extent are we going to prove to be survivors? And what we're going to do to cope with the situation. Back then, we organized the Workers' Alliance for WPA workers and the unemployed, and the dues were 10 cents a week. And those of us who were supervisors, if we had any affiliation with the Workers' Alliance, were fired, blacklisted. But some of us joined anyway. So much for that for the moment.
What other lessons from that period are applicable today, do you think?
Well, the campaign rhetoric about, you know, education for everybody and health care for everybody, we may in very short order be wondering not, you know, how can I go to college, but where is my next meal coming from? So that everything's changed. And it's like that. Our generations are in hock to China and others. You know, untold generations are going to be in hock trying to pay it back. And I think the key to what we're facing is to what extent we fight back. I was there when Roosevelt got on the radio. There was no television, of course. And that made his talk about economic royalty. And when the South, only whites were voting, and racist demagogues were ruling the roost. And so the South sent back the racist demagogues who were already sitting in the chairs of all the congressional committees, virtually all. And so the South didn't fight back. It voted the wrong way. And this is one of my major concerns. On the one hand, I suppose it's okay to be partisan? May I be partisan?
You bet.
I've been partisan all my life, and it's difficult not to be. And I think it behooves us to be partisan, to write causes. As young Paul Sartre said, to be engaged with the struggles of one's time. And so that's I think, the key to the thing, that on the one hand, when I saw the candidacy of Obama emerge and the movement develop across racial and class and all other lines, party lines, it was, you know, highly gratifying. I'm very, very glad to see it. Now, on the other hand, when I begin to see that there's an almost 50-50 division still, that many millions of Americans, in my opinion, voting prepared to vote against themselves. My judgment is that if you're making less than $250,000 a year and voting that way, you're being suckered. And P.T. Barnum, the circus tycoon, many decades ago said that there's a sucker born every minute. And it's my observation that there's been a great explosion in the sucker birth rate.
Stetson, can you comment on the value of the work that we do as historians at a time like this?
Well, I'd like to pick up on something that was said in the introductory remarks about the validity of oral history. Since I was there in the beginning, when the term oral history had not yet been coined, and we spoke instead about life histories, and meaning the same thing. But we would send out the field workers with instructions to look for pioneers, settlers, and old-timers. So those were the three labels that we used in doing and ex-slave interviews, of course. So we were doing it without, we were doing oral history without knowing it. But my opinion back then and now was that the validity arises from the fact that the informants are in very many cases either participants in the action that they're describing, the history they're describing, they either participated or observed or were eyewitnesses. And this is something the standard historian cannot say. And in addition, all of our other sensory organs were involved. When you're a participant and an eyewitness, there's a great deal of involvement, and all of the organs are there, and emotional reactions. And those things, I think, are of great value in the understanding of what actually happened. So any errors in dates and names and so forth that the informant in oral history may make, I think any leave that to some clerks to straighten out. But the validity of the oral history remains.
Could you talk about the spirit that you and your co-workers had when you were beginning this work that you called Life History and Collection of Folklore?
Say it again.
What was the spirit amongst you and your colleagues when you did the work?
Well, let's say for your Library of Congress collection, I think I used the title Florida Treasure Hunt. And that's the answer to your question. We thought we were on a treasure hunt, and as excited as a bunch of kids. And every time anyone found a bit of treasure, we would pass it around and enjoy.
Can you give us some examples of the treasure?
It's all in your archives, not mine.
I could go look it up. Well, you've got some of that material in your book, right?
I remember the Florida Times Union said thousands of canned Florida folk songs sent to Washington.
There it is, right there.
I'll be damned.
This is the Jacksonville Journal, 1939. The title, Can Folklore, Can Florida Folk Songs Go to Washington? 80 Florida Folk Songs, transcribed on phonograph records by two WPA project workers in a statewide tour, being forwarded from Jacksonville to Washington this week for deposit in the Library of Congress. There they will be available for students of folklore and music in the United States. Most of the 80 songs, WPA officials reported, were picked up at Riviera, a community of West Indies fisherfolk immigrants lying just north of Palm Beach and also known as Conch Town, Ybor City, Spanish Quarter of Tampa, and Key West. Stetson Kennedy and Robert Cook are the project workers who made the tour and transcriptions. The song recording tour was sponsored by WPA Music Writers and Art Projects. There we go, part of the documentation.
Well, where were we? Back in Florida?
Yeah, I want to go back in Florida.
Uh-huh.
How did you get started with all this?
By collecting. My father was a retail furniture merchant, and he had a large business in the so-called dollar down and dollar a week. And young couples would come in, newlyweds, holding hands, and saying, we want to set up housekeeping. And they had no money, and very often had no job. So my father actually became something of a one-man social agency and would set them up with the basics, a bed and a stove, and then tell them to come back after they'd paid off some of that balance and he'd get some more furniture. So that's the way life was back then, and my job was to go collect the dollar bills after school hours and during summer vacations. And I recall one mother holding the dollar bill in my face and saying, if I give you this dollar, my kids will go to bed hungry tonight. So there I was, a teenager, with that kind of dilemma, take the dollar or not. And that's the way it was.
Where was that in Florida?
I was in Jacksonville at that time.
And how did that lead you to doing?
Well, I've forgotten your question. In the course of collecting the dollar bills from both black and white poor people, a lot of the things they were saying caught my ear. And I started taking notes, and they were saying things like, we came to call it folk say, short, pithy things, which said a lot. For example, the elderly black man who said, when you in Rome, Georgia, you got to act like it. And I thought that summed up the Jim Crow system in its entirety, all in one, a one-liner. And other things like, I feed white folks with a long spoon. And if you ain't got no education, you got to use your brain.
We're writing that one down, yeah.
Well, ask me another.
Okay.
I can't read my notes.
How did that initial interest lead you to get a job working for the WPA?
Well, I invented independent studies by dropping out of the University of Florida and shipped a trunkload of books from Jacksonville by water to Key West and hitchhiked behind them. And this was in 1935, and the 35 hurricane had just wiped out all the veterans who had been sent. You remember the March on Washington, and instead of doing something for them, they wanted to be paid the bonus it was coming to them, but they wanted it a bit in advance of what the promise called for. And General MacArthur, instead of getting their bonus for having fought for democracy in World War One, General MacArthur attacked them and tore, burned up their tent fence in Washington. And the only thing that was done for them, they were offered these jobs working on the overseas highway in the Florida Keys. And so that's when I went down, and I don't want to take up all the time with the hurricane. The depression was hurricane enough, and it was affecting everyone. But when I got to Key West, I started hearing things again, such as when the wind is walking right, the water is crystal as gin. And so I started taking notes in Key West, and eventually I had a good many pages of them. And a bit later, I was back at the University of Florida organizing American Student Union. And Florida Intercollegiate Peace Council, it was the first biracial student group, I think, ever in the South. And we had to meet behind closed doors for fear of drawn blinds, I meant to say, for fear of drive-by Klan dynamiting. So we met on black campuses. It was impossible for us to meet on white campuses. As an aside, in introduction, Charles Seeger came to Jacksonville to speak to the WPA leaders, and shortly thereafter there was a meeting scheduled for a music project of composers, and one of the composers on the panel was black. And when the head of the Florida WPA heard that, he said it was utterly unthinkable for a black to appear on a platform in a status of equality with whites. So the panel was canceled.
Now, I know from the other day you were telling me about your job offer coming through Benjamin Botkin, who was the head of the Federal Writers Project.
Yes, this list that I mentioned of folks from Key West, and I sent, I'd gone back to Gainesville, and while in Gainesville, the Writers Project was created, had been created in 35, and it occurred to me that it might be a good thing for me to join the project, and this was 1937. And so I applied in Gainesville. In order to get any WPA job, one had to take the pauper's oath.
The what?
Pauper's oath.
Yeah.
Sorry about my voice. We had to swear that you have no money, no job, no property, and no prospect of getting any of those things. And I was eminently qualified. So I got the job.